when you hear a show tune from the Great White Way, does a shiver run through ya? Well, we're giving them to ya. Sing hallelujah and shout hooray. Come on along and listen to Broadway to Main Street. USA.
By God, I have had this Congress. For 10 years, King George and his Parliament have gulled, cullied, and diddled these colonies, and still this Congress refuses to grant any of my proposals on independence, even so much as the courtesy of open debate. Good God, what in hell are they waiting for?
Sit down, John! Sit down, John! For God's sake, John!
Say vote yes, vote yes, vote for independence.
Somebody open up a window.
I say vote yes.
Sit down, John.
Vote for independence.
Somebody open up a window.
No, no, no. Too many flies.
Consider yourselves fortunate that you have John Adams to abuse, for no sane man would tolerate it!
John, you're a bore. We've heard this before. Now for God's sake, John, sit down!
I say vote yes,
no.
Vote yes,
no.
Vote for independence sake.
Someone ought to open up a window.
I say vote yes,
sit down, John.
Vote for independence sake.
Well, never say never, because today we have one of the great sit-downs of Broadway to Main Street history. I am joined today by one of the finest actors ever to grace the Broadway stage, Mr. William Daniels. Welcome, Mr. Daniels.
Larry, thank you for that introduction.
This is Larry Maslon, your host for Broadway to Main Street on WPPB 88.3 FM Peconic Public Broadcasting, emanating today out of the independence-minded studio in New York City. And typically, this would be our July 4th show, but who better in the whole world to spend July 4th with than William Daniels, whose performance as John Adams in 1776 made an incredible impression on me. It was the first show I ever saw from the back row of the 46th Street Theater. I still have the program and the souvenir program.
Oh, my goodness.
And I think, without being too hyperbolic, if I haven't already, without you and without that show, I would never have been kindled with this great affection for the American musical theater.
Really?
So you changed my life. You changed the lives of so many people who've enjoyed your work.
Well,
and I hope you can spend a little bit of time looking at your life and looking at your work, because okay. You have a new book out.
Yes, that's right.
There I go again.
Right.
Potomac Books.
Yes, exactly.
And did you have fun writing it?
I wrote it on and off for a couple of years, really. I didn't know whether it would be published or not. What I was trying to do was remember where I've been and what the journey was like and where I was today.
Well, I think it has all the hallmarks of a great theater book, because obviously there's a lot about 1776,
mm-hmm.
but it's such a good book about the actor's process, about what you went through as an actor,
mm-hmm.
and the people in the 20th century American theater that you encountered were extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true.
So I can't recommend it enough to theater goers and theater lovers out there, and we'll talk a little more about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you weren't exactly born in a trunk, but I think you were born and put into a trunk pretty quickly by your mom. You
know? Yes, that's true. I had a showbiz mom who herself could have been, but she was so stage fright that she couldn't do it. So she led her children, my two sisters and myself, very early on, into performing. In radio, we started in radio and then went to television and that sort of thing.
Sounds like a good idea for a musical. A stage mother who wants to put her kids on stage.
Haven't I seen that musical?
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. Well, I know that you grew up in the New York area.
Yes.
I grew up in Malvern, which is near Valley Stream,
sure,
so I was thrilled
absolutely
to read that in your book. And for me, as I said, this is exciting to meet a great celebrity I admire. But let's hear a great celebrity you admired who did you a very good turn. Here is a cut from the one, the only, Bill Bojangles Robinson, who our guest William Daniels listened to in the front row seat at the Cotton Club when he was but a tyke.
Listen, good folks, it isn't alcohol, no y'all a gal at all. Thrill me with the pep I've got. I got a pair of feet that have found that low-down beat. Low-down, down around the spot that's hot. Have no peace losing my lease on living. Here's the how I'm telling you now to give in. Make 'em play that crazy thing again. I got to do that lazy swing again. Hi-ho, doing the new lowdown. Got my feet to misbehaving now. Got a soul that's not for saving now. Hi-ho, doing the new lowdown. That dancing demon, he has my feet in a trance. 'Cause when I'm dreaming, folks, I go right into that dance. Once you hear that haunting strain to it, I bet my life you'll go insane to it. Hi-ho, doing the new lowdown.
Well, I wrote him the only fan letter that I've ever written, and by God, he sent back a note, handwritten, from Detroit, where he was playing, and he invited me with one of my parents, anyone, to his opening at the Cotton Club in New York.
Wow.
And my mother and I went, and we had a seat right. There was this thrust stage, and I was here. Just my chin was just above the stage, and he came out and he talked, and then he did his. He starts. What he starts doing is a little bit of something, you know, a little soft shoe, and pretty soon he came over and he leaned over and he said, "This is for you," and he went his slapstick, which I tried to do for years, but I couldn't do it like him.
Well, not everybody's Bojangles Robinson,
no.
So it's okay.
And he did that. Oh my God, all the way.
Wow.
And all we had, I remember, was ginger ale. And my mother called for the check. He said, "No, no, this is on Mr. Robinson." I thought, I could have had a hamburger. All we had was ginger ale.
Well, he didn't disappoint, did he?
No.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to a special edition of Broadway to Main Street here on WPPB with the only person you would want to spend July 4th weekend with if you're a musical theater fan, the one, the only William Daniels, who, of course, played John Adams in the original production of 1776.
Dear God, for one solid year they have been sitting here, a whole year, doing nothing. I do believe you've laid a curse on North America. A curse that we here now rehearse in Philadelphia. A second flood, a simple famine, plagues of locusts everywhere, or a cataclysmic earthquake, I'd accept with some despair. But no, you sent us Congress. Good God, sir, was that fair? I say this with humility in Philadelphia, where your responsibility in Philadelphia. If you don't want to see us hanging from some far-off British hill, if you don't want the voice of independency forever still, then God, sir, get thee to it, for Congress never will. You see, we piddle, twiddle, and resolve. Not one damn thing do we solve. Piddle, twiddle, and resolve. Nothing's ever solved in foul, fetid, fuming, foggy, filthy Philadelphia.
Someone ought to open up a window.
Good God! They may sit here for years and years in Philadelphia. These indecisive grenadiers of Philadelphia. They can't agree on what is right and wrong or what is good or bad. I'm convinced the only purpose this Congress ever had was to gather here specifically to drive John Adams mad. You see, we piddle, twiddle, and resolve. Not one damn thing do we solve. Piddle, twiddle, and resolve. Nothing's ever solved in foul, fetid, fuming, foggy, filthy Philadelphia.
John, John, is that you carrying on? John.
Oh, Abigail, Abigail, I have such a desire to knock heads together.
I know, my dearest, I know. But that's because you make everything so complicated. It's all quite simple, really. Hmm? Just tell the Congress to declare independency. Then sign your name, get out of there, and hurry home to me. Our children all have dysentery. Little Tom keeps turning blue. Little Abby has the measles, and I'm coming down the flu. They say we may get smallpox.
Madam, what else is new? Abigail, in my last letter, I wrote you to organize the ladies to make saltpeter for gunpowder. Have you done as I asked?
No, John, I have not.
Why have you not?
John, I'm afraid we have a more urgent problem.
More urgent, madam?
There's one thing every woman's missed in Massachusetts Bay. Don't smirk at me, you egotist. Pay heed to what I say. We've gone from Framingham to Boston, and we cannot find a pin. Don't you know there is a war on, say the tradesman with a grin? Well, we will not make saltpeter until you send us pins.
Pins, madam, saltpeter.
Pins.
Saltpeter.
Pins.
Saltpeter.
Pins.
Saltpeter.
Pins.
Peter.
Pins.
Peter.
Pins.
Peter.
Pins.
Peter.
Pins.
Done, madam. Done.
Done, John. Hurry home, John.
Oh, as soon as I'm able.
Don't stop writing. It's all I have.
Every day, my dearest friend.
Till then.
Till then.
And we are having, for me, a once-in-a-lifetime sit-down with William Daniels himself here today on Broadway to Main Street. You have this wonderful new memoir out called There I Go Again, and I thought I knew everything about you because I would go to Lincoln Center Library and look at your clippings, and I think I wrote you a fan note once, which I don't know, it came back to me in the mail in 1979.
I never got it?
Well, it came back in the mail, so I obviously didn't have the right address.
Yeah.
But one of the things I learned, which astonished me, was, and it didn't surprise me really, because you're such an acute and smart actor, that you would also have a great directorial sensibility. And you apprenticed, or you assisted, one of the great directors of the 20th century on one of the great musicals of the 20th century, which was Gypsy.
Yeah, Jerry Robbins. And that was a very wonderful experience. I assisted him, and he was very good with me. He knew that I was an actor. I remember at one time we were in Philadelphia, and they were playing a scene, and he said to me, "What's the matter with this scene?" I said, "How should I know? You're the director." And that shut him up.
Well, he was fascinating to me. I mean, he's fascinating to everyone. But I think both he and you worked at the Actors Studio.
Yes.
And as someone who was trained in dance, I think he was always trying to understand what actors were about.
That's exactly right, yes. And You know, he was curious about it. He was curious about the notion of what goes on subconsciously in a performer and so forth. But, you know, he had to be careful who he was talking to. If he was talking to a very strong-minded actress, she could put him right under the ground as
well.
Far as
so what was, do you think he turned, do you think he gave Merman the performance of her career, or you think they collaborated? I know they had some tense moments where she quote-unquote wanted to do Merman, but he was saying, no, you've got to play Rose, that's why you're doing the show. Do you have some opinion about that?
Well, the only thing I can tell you about that is that I think that Miss Merman was very happy to be working with the top people in our business at the time. That was Leland Haywood, the producer, and Jerry Robbins as director. She was very happy to be working with these guys. And so she was open, ready to learn, and actually she had a kind of an epiphany moment when we were rehearsing it when she was doing My Turn.
Mm-hmm. Rose's Turn.
And she broke up right in the middle of it and kept singing. And it was wonderful, absolutely. And she tried to get that again, but never actually did. You know, she kind of faked it a little. But other than that, I think it was a very strong performance all around, and she was very happy with everybody.
Some people can get a thrill knitting sweaters and sitting still. That's okay for some people who don't know they're alive. Some people can thrive and bloom living life in a living room. That's perfect for some people of 105. But I at least gotta try. When I think of all the sights that I gotta see, yet all the places I gotta play, all the things that I gotta be, yet come on, Papa, what do you say? Some people can be content playing bingo and paying rent. That's peachy for some people, for some humdrum people to be. But some people ain't me. I had a dream, a wonderful dream, Papa. June and the Orpheum Circuit, give me a chance and I know I can work it. I had a dream, just as real as can be, Papa. There I was in Mr. Orpheum's office, and he was saying to me, Rose, get yourself some new orchestrations, new routines and red velvet curtains, get a feathered hat for the baby, photographs in front of the theater, get an agent, and in jig time you'll be being booked in a big time. Oh, what a dream, a wonderful dream, Papa, and all that I need is 88 bucks, Papa. That's what he said, Papa, only 88 bucks, Papa.
You ain't getting 88 cents from me, Rose.
Then I'll get it someplace else, but I'll get it and get my kids out. Goodbye to blueberry pie. Good riddance to all the socials I had to go to, all the lodges I had to play, all the shriners I said hello to. Hey, L.A., I'm coming your way. Some people sit on their butts, got the dream, yeah, but not the guts. That's living for some people, for some humdrum people, I suppose. Well, they can stay and rot. But not rot.
So, Bill, even though you started as a song and dance boy, youngster in the field, you really didn't get your Broadway musical theater debut until On a Clear Day, You Can See Forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine some of that has to do with your co-star from the film is Of a Thousand Clowns, Barbara Harris, one of the great, great, mm-hmm. great talents of the 1960s
That's
on stage.
Right. Actually, I turned it down because it was not a very interesting part and everything. So, and Alan Lerner asked me to come in and see him, and he said, why did you turn it down? I said, it's just a small part, you know, or anything. He said, what if I wrote you a song? I said, well, you know, I knew an actor who went to Boston with three songs and came back with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
He said, how about I promise you that if you don't come back with that song, you can leave the show.
Wow.
So my agent said, Bill, you can't. You have to.
Yeah, it doesn't come along
so
very often.
So he won't wait till you're 65.
All right, let's hear it.
Guaranteed income, house with a view, doctors and nurses, surgery too, everything paid for, and it comes true. When we're 65, 10, 20, 30, then we're 40, wait till we're 65. No need to hurry, not a worry left but to keep alive. Not another premium to pay. All we've got to do now is play and play. 6 years or seven, then to heaven, me first, the record show. You get the pension, not to mention Blue Cross until you go. If you ever thought you had fun at 21, wait till we're 65. Hop, skip to 40, jump to 50, wait till we're 65. Paid up and grinning, just beginning now to become alive.
If the children never mature,
what the hell, the bonds will, so we're secure. Safe from disaster, no one has to take care of Ma and Pa. All brown and rosy, living cozy down there in Tampa, Florida. If you feel like Catherine the Great at 28, wait till we're 65. Life will be gala, every malady all completely paid, and we've a plot of terracotta in which we'll both be laid. If you were a little forlorn when you were born, wait till we're 65.
Well, I'm glad I didn't have to wait till I was 65 to share a recording booth with the one and only Mr. William Daniels. Did you have fun doing that show? I know kind of a famous mess.
Oh, yes. It was a lot of fun. And Herb Ross was wonderful to work with. I remember there was a moment where he found out that I was a tap dancer. So during rehearsals, I did a tap dance with these really good dancers, and you know, it was a 3/4 beat, which they were having trouble with and I couldn't handle, and I did my little tap dance, and then I think it was the second day or the third day, Herb Ross said, Bill, yeah, The tap dance is out. I love it.
And you took it with equanimity, no doubt.
Oh, yes.
let's turn to, for musical theater fans, certainly the most momentous decision of your career, a history professor slash Tin Pan Alley composer named Sherman Edwards, who had some pop hits for Elvis Presley, would sit in Morristown, New Jersey, in the public library in the John Adams Reading Room. I don't know if you knew that.
No.
And for years he did this research about the Founding Fathers to write a musical, of all things, about the Declaration of Independence.
Yes.
And if there was ever a ridiculous, uncommercial, unplayable, unthinkable idea, it was this one.
That's right. That's right.
Do you remember when you first came across it?
Yes. I was in a living room and a couple of people read it, and I thought it was rather stiff and unwieldy. And then, of course, they got Peter. Peter Stone made that thing a success. He went back to the history and literally lifted what some of these men actually said, which was so much better than a writer making it up.
Uh-huh.
And when he did that, then we really had something.
So Peter Stone, who had done a couple of books for some Broadway shows, came in under Stuart Ostrow, the producer, asked him to come in, and I assume Sherman Edwards was okay with it because
it
took it to another level.
Sure. And absolutely. And he loosened it up. He put wit into it where it didn't have any. And he was very instrumental in making a success of the show. Not to take anything away from Sherman Edwards, he wrote the book. So that was the way it came about.
Well, let's hear a little bit. I'm going to play from the soundtrack recording, which has our good friend Howard Da Silva on it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's hear a little of But Mr. Adams from the soundtrack, and then we'll talk a little bit about being cast, and we'll talk a little bit about Howard Da Silva.
Okay.
All right, gentlemen, let's get on with it. Which of us will write our Declaration of Independence?
Mr. Adams, I say you should write it. To your legal mind and brilliance we defer.
Is that so? Well, if I'm the one to do it, they'll run their quill pens through it. I'm obnoxious and disliked, you know that, sir.
Yes, I know.
But I say you should write it. Franklin, yes, you.
Hell no.
Yes, you, Dr. Franklin. You.
But.
You.
But.
You.
But. Mr. Adams. But, Mr. Adams. The things I write are only light extemporanea. I won't put politics on paper, it's a mania. So I refuse to use the pen in Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania, refuse to use the pen.
Mr. Sherman, I say you should write it. You are never controversial, as it were.
That is true.
Whereas if I'm the one to do it, they'll run their quill pens through it. I'm obnoxious and disliked, you know that, sir.
Yes, I do.
So I say you should write it. Roger, yes, you.
Good heavens, no.
Yes, you, Roger Sherman. You.
But.
You.
But.
You.
But.
Mr. Adams. But, Mr. Adams. I cannot write with any style or proper etiquette. I don't know a participle from a predicate. I am just a simple cobbler from Connecticut.
Connecticut, Connecticut, a simple cobbler.
Mr. Livingston, maybe you should write it. You have many friends and you're a diplomat.
Oh, that word.
Whereas if I'm the one to do it, they'll run their quill pens through it.
He's obnoxious and disliked, did you know that?
I hadn't heard.
So I say you should write it. Robert, yes, you.
Not me, Johnny.
Yes, you, Robert Livingston, you.
But,
you.
But,
you.
But. Mr. Adams.
Adams, dear Mr. Adams, I've been presented with a new son by the noble sort. So I am going home to celebrate and pop the cork with all the Livingstons to gather back in old New York. New York!
Mr. Jefferson.
Mr. Adams, leave me alone.
Mr. Jefferson.
Mr. Adams, I beg of you, I've not seen my wife these past 6 months.
And we solemnly declare that we will preserve our liberties, being with one mind resolved to die free men rather than to live slaves. Thomas Jefferson, on the necessity of taking up arms, 1775... Magnificent. Why, you write 10 times better than any man in Congress, including me. For a man of only 33 years, you possess a happy talent for composition and a remarkable felicity of expression. Now then, sir, will you be a patriot or a lover?
A lover.
No.
But I burn, Mr. A.
So do I, Mr. J.
You?
You do.
John, who'd have thought it?
Mr. Jefferson, dear Mr. Jefferson, I'm only 41. I still have my virility. And I can romp through Cupid's Grove with great agility. But life is more than sexual combustibility.
Combustibility! Combustibility!
Quiet! Now you'll write it, Mr. J.
Who will make me, Mr. A?
I.
You?
Yes.
How?
By physical force, if necessary. It's your duty, damn it. Your duty!
Mr. Adams! Damn you, Mr. Adams! You're obnoxious and disliked, that cannot be denied. Once again you stand between me and my lovely bride.
Lovely bride!
Oh, Mr. Adams, you are driving me to homicide!
Homicide! Homicide!
The decision is yours, Mr. Jefferson. Do as you like with it.
We may see murder, yeah.
Wow, from the soundtrack of 1776. So let's talk about Howard De Silva first, and then I want to get back to how you got into the show. Now, Howard De Silva is an interesting guy to me because, as you can gather, I like theater history. So here's a man who was in the original Cradle of Rock.
Yes.
The original Oklahoma.
Right, he played Judd.
He played Judd, the original Fiorello.
Mm-hmm.
And I gather he was... So tell us why people who have listened to this show forever on the cast album didn't hear Howard De Silva, and a little bit about what it was like to work with him.
Yes. They didn't hear it because he had a heart problem. And he played for as long as he could, and then I remember a performance where he had to go to the hospital. There was an ambulance waiting for him, and he finished the damn show. I couldn't believe it. And he was out, unfortunately, for the recording of the show, which always takes place the Sunday after you open, the first Sunday, so they can get it out right away. And he missed that. But Howard was a trooper, a real trooper. We had a kind of love-hate relationship. I have to be perfectly frank. He loved me, I loved him. But he insisted on trying to dominate everything, you know, that he was in. And he was a big man.
Yeah.
And I remember once coming off stage in rehearsals, standing next to Billy, who was playing the messenger. And I'm saying, man, I'm tired. He said, that's because he's leaning on you. I said, really? Oh, yeah, he's putting his weight on you. I said, uh-huh. So we had canes, you know.
Right.
So the next time that scene came up, he came near me and I put the cane up right into his chest. I said, you know, we're used to speaking loud and I need the room.
Hmm.
And that was the end.
Well.
But he could be also terribly, terribly interested and cooperative. It was just that he liked to steal the scenes if he could, even at the point of where he used to fall asleep as
Franklin.
And, you know, that was all right, except when he started snoring so loud that I just went over with the cane and whacked it on his table, and he went, oh! And that was that. He would do anything to misbehave. I mean, he was like a kid on the stage.
Well,
but I loved him. I loved him.
But, of course, an actor always uses what they have. Franklin and Adams have about something like that. So tell me a little bit about how you found out about John Adams, how you got the part, which Bonnie Bartlett, your lovely wife, who's here in the studio, said, oh, come on, it's just like you. Did you think that when you read that?
Well, I thought it was a bad idea to be doing something like this, which I thought was a lot of flag waving when we had troops in Vietnam where they shouldn't have been, and I thought this was a bad time to do this show. I'm wrong about just about anything I do. I have a whole negative attitude. It's a problem of mine. I only see the problems in something. I don't see that it's really, besides that, it's really good, you know.
You look for the jet black lining.
Yes, exactly right. And so that was one of them. And Bonnie and Jerry Friedman said, come on, Bill, you know, go and what did I do? Did I sing a song or something like that?
I think you sang Wait Till We're 65, which you had sung for a year.
Yeah, I got about 8 bars into it, and I went cold. I went blank, and I said, Jesus, I did this for 4 months. I'm doing it now, I think I was. Anyway, they all laughed, and you know, they just wanted to hear me sing a little. But I did. I went up on the lyric.
Nowadays, I suppose, I know you have a long history with the, as it were, the Adams family, 1D. I know you played his son and you played his cousin later on.
I have a fix on the Adamses.
Did you do a lot of research? Did you look at papers? You frankly, and I think it's to your credit, didn't look very much like him. He was a much sort of plumper, balder fellow.
That's right.
But did you do any sort of actor's studio look into his life, or you just went with the emotions that were projected so clearly in the show?
Well, the problem, I think, for an actor is not to often, I shouldn't say always, but not to go to another source, but to stick with the play and what the play presents. There are a lot of colors in a person that the play doesn't include, and so why get yourself all involved with that? The play itself presents enough problems for you to concentrate on,
mm-hmm.
And I did not do any research. I just did the play. Afterwards, people sent me all kinds of books, and I read about it. But during it, it was the play that I tried to fulfill.
Well, you mentioned to me the previous time we met that David McCullough, who wrote the definitive work on John Adams, in 2000, 2001, actually sent you a copy.
Oh, yes, he did. And very graciously autographed it and said something about... what was it, Bonnie, he said?
The only man who knows more.
He said, on it, he said, the only man who knows more about John Adams than I do.
Well,
which I thought was very complimentary.
You certainly lived in his shoes with the buckles and everything. This is Larry Maslon, your host for Broadway to Main Street here on WPPB 88.3 FM. And today, on our special July 4th broadcast, we are joined by none other than William Daniels, the original John Adams of 1776, on stage and on film. One of the great things about 1776, as you said earlier, Peter Stone managed to draft in a lot of the actual material that guys wrote or spoke, insofar as we know it,
mm-hmm.
and probably no more successfully than the letters of John and Abigail. I have a 9-year-old son, and he was reading some kid's book. He said, "Dad, it's all letters." And I said, "Yes, it's epistolary." And he said, "Ooh, that's a big word." But one of the wonderful things about 1776 is even though they had this great love affair, mm-hmm. Which continued, obviously, when he went to the White House, they managed to keep a distance between you. I think it says certain regions of John Adams' mind is the stage direction where Abigail lives. And that's very atypical, but wonder it's all about 1776 did everything differently. Every rule it broke. So what was it like having, as it were, your love partner not literally on stage with you, but back up in Braintree? I mean, mm-hmm. that must have been provided some interesting acting challenges.
Well, that was part of their life as well. I mean, he spent a great deal of time away. When you think it took 3 weeks to get from his house down to Philadelphia, distances were important. And of course, and then he was in Europe without her sometimes with her. So they spent a lot of time. But, you know, she was her own woman. Mm-hmm. And she, I don't know if she was writing or what, but she was very important as saying, "John, remember the women."
You right.
know? And so she is like the patron saint, I think, of feminism in the country today.
Wow, well put. Well, let's hear you and the wonderful Virginia Vestoff singing mm-hmm. A great duet from 1776.
Like a monk in an abbey, ditto, ditto, I hate it.
Write to me with sentimental effusion. Let me revel in romantic illusion.
Do you still smell of vanilla and spring air? And is my favorite lover's pillar still firm and fair?
But while dear John still is there, John, come soon as you can to my cloister. I've forgotten the feel of your hand.
Madam, we shall walk in Cupid's grove together, and we'll fondly survey that promised land. Till then, I am as I ever was and ever shall be.
You know, we talked about the love affair between John Adams and Abigail Adams, and I think we would be remiss if we did not talk about the great love of your life, who's in our studio today, Bonnie Bartlett, mm-hmm. with whom you've acted and performed many times.
Yes,
so that must have been a huge backbone for you emotionally in your career.
Oh, absolutely. Bonnie is my strong arm to lean on and a good critic of my work. Actually, we've been married a long time, and I think it's really based on a mutual respect of each other, and particularly our individual talents. She's won 2 Emmys, and she's a marvelous actress. And so it's been a very, very happy life I've had. I'm a very lucky man.
Well, I'd like to talk about something, if you would, because I think it's important for listeners and to sort of for posterity, which John Adams was always concerned with. Could we talk a little about the Tony Awards when 1776 came out? Because I think it's important to know the integrity that you went into that process with.
Oh, I'll have to put my mind back to it.
Back then, to be a star, you had to have your name above the title.
Yes, and they nominated me for a supporting role, and I said, thank you very much. I won't be available for that. And the producer called me and said, but Bill, what do you mean? I said, who am I supporting? He said, well, you see, you came out late. The show came out late in the spring, and that category was already fixed of leading men. I said, so good, leave me out of it. He said, well, we want you there. Are you sure? I said, no. He said, you won't be there? I said, no, I won't be there. Thank you very much. But I wasn't just speaking for myself. I was speaking for the show, and the show did win the award as the best musical of that year. But I couldn't see myself standing up there and talking about a supporting role.
I think I read maybe you were quoted as saying that you were on stage the whole 2.5 hours.
Yes, I had 9 musical numbers.
Right. So that's bigger than Tevye. I mean, that's bigger than Billy Bigelow.
I know. So I didn't attend. And some people made an issue out of that, but I just couldn't... I couldn't accept that, and it was not right for the show. It was not right for me. I wasn't supporting anybody.
Let's talk briefly about the White House. You were the first musical to perform in the White House, and while that sounds, on the face of it, certainly interesting, this was no ordinary time and no ordinary White House and no ordinary cast to bring down there.
Yes. It was during a presidency of a man that I didn't agree with or didn't like much, and... the producer turned it down over an issue. There were several issues. One was that the White House wanted to cut cool conservative men.
Cool considerate men.
Cool considerate men.
Yeah.
And on the basis of that, the producer turned them down several times. So this was a negotiation that went on with the White House until finally they said, oh, okay.
And you got to commune, at least, with the spirit of John Adams in the White House. I think there's a wonderful photo in your book, in your new memoir of you standing right next to a portrait.
Under that photo, that portrait, wonderful portrait. Yeah. Yes, that's true.
Now, let's take a look at one more song in 1776. Now, out-of-town tryouts are hell, we know that. 1776... did not have, quote-unquote, a big box office star. It seemed like an absurd idea. But I gather that there was a scene cut in, I want to say, Boston, and Sherman Edwards got the inspiration for the song from the poster, which was a little eaglet popping out of the shell of King George III.
Oh, yes, yes.
And that song was?
I don't know.
It's The Egg.
Oh, The Egg, right.
So you had to learn something at the last minute.
Howard never cared for the song. Really? I said, come on, Howard, you know, do it. But it was fun to do, really, really.
Well, let's hear Howard and you and the lovely Ken Howard sing The Egg from the film of 1776.
It's a masterpiece, I say. They will cheer every word, every letter.
I wish I felt that way.
I believe I can put it better. Now then, attend, as friend to friend, our declaration committee. For us, I see immortality
in Philadelphia City.
A farmer, a lawyer, and a sage. A bit gouty in the leg. You know, it's quite bizarre to think that here we are, playing midwives to an egg.
Egg? What egg?
America, the birth of a new nation. Only we can be sure of what kind of a bird it's going to be. Thomas the Poet, what sort of bird shall we choose as the symbol of our new America?
The eagle.
The dove, the turkey,
the eagle,
the dove,
the eagle,
the eagle, the turkey,
eagle is a majestic bird.
The eagle is a scavenger, a thief, and a coward. A symbol of over 10 centuries of European mischief.
A turkey?
The turkey is a truly noble bird. Native American, source of sustenance of our original settlers. An incredibly brave fellow who will not flinch at attacking a regiment of Englishmen single-handedly. Therefore, the national bird of America is going to be...
The eagle.
The eagle.
We're waiting for the chirp, chirp, chirp of an eaglet being born. Waiting for the chirp, chirp, chirp on this humid Monday morning in this congressional incubator.
God knows the temperature's hot enough to hatch a stone, let alone an egg.
We're waiting for the scratch, scratch, scratch of that tiny little fellow. Waiting for the egg to hatch on this humid Monday morning in this congressional incubator. God knows the temperature's hot enough to hatch a stone,
but will it hatch an egg?
The Declaration will be a triumph, I tell you, a triumph. If I was ever sure of anything, I'm sure of that. A triumph. And if it isn't, we've still got 4 days left to think of something else. The eagle's going to crack the shell of the egg that England laid. Yes, so we can tell, tell, tell on this humid Monday morning in this congressional incubator.
And just as Tom here has written, though the shell may belong to Great Britain, the eagle inside belongs to us.
And just as Tom here has written, we say to hell with Great Britain, the eagle inside belongs to us.
Great moment from 1776.
I have to say, I do not have the energy today to do what we did in that show then.
You try to condense, as Shakespeare says, you know, many hours into a minute here. You had a wonderful career on St. Elsewhere, Knight Rider, moved to California. But recently, within the last year or so, you returned to what was the 46th Street Theater, is now the Richard Rogers Theater, to see the show about the founding fathers that has influenced a whole nother generation of youngsters and grown-ups, which is Hamilton.
Oh, yes.
And so what was the experience of going back to that theater? I know you went backstage and met Lin-Manuel
yes,
Miranda.
Yes, well, we had a fellow helping us, leading us around, because you couldn't get a ticket for that show. It was so hot. And
not even John Adams.
Uh-huh.
John, not even John Adams could get a ticket.
No, no.
You're mentioned in the show, for Pete's sake. You should get a royalty.
Well, we went back and met Lin-Manuel, who is a gracious, open, wonderful, talented, everything. He's extraordinary. He wrote it, starred in it, and it was a huge hit and deserved to be. And I had a ball watching it.
He tipped you off that a reference to John Adams might not be so salubrious in the show. So John Adams gets a sort of negative shout-out in the musical.
Yeah, well, you know, John, you could do that with John. He was a... obnoxious and disliked.
Right. That cannot be denied.
That cannot be denied.
But let me ask you, for a character who is not Nelson Eddy, right? He's not even Billy Bigelow.
No.
This show, as I said earlier in the Broadway to Main Street broadcast, it's the first show I ever saw. And it's not just me. It has inflamed the imagination and the passion of generations of either people who saw it in the theater or, of course, saw the movie, which had pretty much the original cast.
Yes, right.
Which was a very, very rare idea.
That's right.
What do you think it is about 1776 that just grabs people and never lets them go if they're in the right frame of mind?
Well, first of all, it's what happened to make our country, you know, and how it happened. And that's very appealing to people. And then the characters were not only just acceptables, I think they wound up being lovable. And there was a lot to it that was appealing to people, even though there was a lot of problems with Vietnam at the time. And so my worry about that was put aside, because it didn't matter that this show, in fact, it was almost serendipitous that it was playing at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because I think we needed a little something about the country.
But it was not, I mean, you said when you auditioned for it, you thought it was a flag-waving show. And they didn't really have the flag yet, right? That's the whole point of the show. But there was always something about it that, depending on what side of the political spectrum you were on, you could engage in it, because
yes,
if you were from the South, you could mm-hmm. see their point of view. Or from the North, you could take umbrage against that.
Mm,
so,
yeah.
So I think
exactly.
It was like Shakespeare, really. You can do Henry V, and it appeals to doves and to hawks alike, because
yes.
it's so broad
yes.
in its writing.
That's very true. Yes, it's very true. I think both sides of the issues were represented in the show. And anybody could go and see it and take some satisfaction out of it.
Well, can I tell you why I think it's so appealing and you're so appealing in it?
Mm.
I think when you're a young person, especially, what you know about your country's history is either a dusty textbook,
yes,
or maybe somebody in office who you may not agree with. But you had such integrity as a character. You had commitment. That's the phrase you keep using over and over
yes.
again. That I think for many young people, it was their first exposure to the personal sacrifice of commitment and integrity. And I think that your personal integrity, Bill, and the characters meshed in such a unforgettable way that people could look at you on that stage and say, you know what, America does stand for something, because the people who created it sacrificed a lot to get there. And I feel now more than ever, we need we need to remember what that's about, because the hard-earned notion of what America's about didn't come easily. And boy, do you and John Adams tell us what that's like.
Well, thank you, Larry. You said it better than I could have. That's very nice to hear. Thank you very much.
Well, let us hear one of the great 11 o'clock numbers in American musical history. William Daniels reminding us that there's nothing more important than commitment. Is anybody there from 1776? Bill, thank you so much for being here.
Okay. Thank you, Larry.
Is anybody there? Does anybody care? Does anybody see what I see? They want me to quit. They say, John, give up the fight. Still to England I say, good night, forever good night. For I have crossed the Rubicon. Let the bridge be burned behind me. Come what may, come what may. Commitment! The croakers all say we'll rue the day. They'll be held to pay in fiery purgatory. Through all the gloom, through all the gloom, I can see the rays of ravishing light and glory. Is anybody there? Does anybody care? Does anybody see what I see? I see fireworks. I see the pageant and hum in the rain. I hear the bells ringing out. I hear the cannons roar. I see Americans, all Americans, free forevermore. How quiet. How quiet the chamber is.
how silent the chamber is. Is anybody there? Does anybody care? Does anybody see what I see?
This is Larry Maslon here at Broadway to Main Street. Let's catch up next Sunday at 3:00.